belong there," Mr. Murray said slowly and distinctly. "We were strangers there, as we are here. I was a prisoner there, and these children rescued me. My youngest son, my baby, is still there, trapped in the dark mind of it." Meg tried to twist around in the beast's arms to glare at her father and Calvin. Why were they being so frank? Weren't they aware of the danger? But again, her anger dissolved as the gentle warmth from the tentacles flowed through her. She realized she could move her fingers and toes with comparative freedom, and the pain was no longer so acute. "We must take this child back with us," the beast holding her said. Meg shouted at her father, "Don't leave me the way you left Charles!" With this burst of terror, a spasm of pain racked her body and she gasped. "Stop fighting," the beast told her. "You make it worse. Relax." "That's what it said," Meg cried. "Father! Calvin, help!" The beast turned toward Calvin and Mr. Murray. "This child is in danger. You must trust us."
"We have no alternative," Mr. Murray said. "Can you save her?"
"I think so."
"May I stay with her?"
"No, but you will not be far away. We feel that you are hungry, tired, that you would like to bathe and rest. And this little, what is the word?"
The beast cocked its tentacles at Calvin.
"Girl," Calvin said.
"This little girl needs prompt and special care. The coldness of the, what is it you call it?"
"The black thing?"
"The black thing, yes. The black thing burns unless it is counteracted properly."
The three beasts stood around Meg, and it seemed that they were feeling into her with their softly waving tentacles. The movement of the tentacles was as rhythmic and flowing as the dance of an undersea plant. And lying there, cradled in the four strange arms, Meg, despite herself, felt a sense of security that was deeper than anything she had known since the days when she lay in her mother's arms in the old rocking chair and was sung to sleep. With her father's help, she had been able to resist it. Now, she could hold out no longer. She leaned her head against the beast's chest and realized that the gray body was covered with the softest, most delicate fur imaginable, and the fur had the same beautiful odor as the air.
"I hope I don't smell awful to it," she thought.
But then she knew with a deep sense of comfort that even if she did smell awful, the beasts would forgive her. As the tall figure cradled her, she could feel the frigid stiffness of her body relaxing against it. This bliss could not come to her from a thing like it. It could only give pain, never relieve it. The beasts must be good. They had to be good. She sighed deeply, like a very small child, and suddenly she was asleep. When she came to herself again, there was in the back of her mind a memory of pain, of agonizing pain. But the pain was over now, and her body was lapped in comfort. She was lying on something wonderfully soft in an enclosed chamber. It was dark. All she could see were occasional tall moving shadows, which she realized were beasts walking about. She had been stripped of her clothes, and something warm and pungent was gently being rubbed into her body. She sighed and stretched and discovered that she could stretch. She could move again. She was no longer paralyzed, and her body was bathed in waves of warmth. Her father had not saved her. The beasts had.
"So are you awake, little one?" The words came gently to her ears. "What a funny little tadpole you are. Is the pain gone now?"
"All gone.
Are you warm and alive again?
Yes, I'm fine. She struggled to sit up.
No, lie still, small one. You must not exert yourself as yet. We will have a fur garment for you in a moment, and then we will feed you. You must not even try to feed yourself. You must be as an infant again. The black thing does not relinquish its victims willingly.
Where are Father and Calvin? Have they gone back for Charles Wallace?
They are eating and resting, the beast said, and we are trying to learn about each other and see what is best to help you. We feel now that you are not dangerous and that we will be allowed to help you.
Why is it so dark in here? Meg asked. She tried to look around, but all she could see was shadows. Nevertheless, there was a sense of openness, a feel of a gentle breeze moving lightly about that kept the darkness from being oppressive. Perplexity came to her from the beast.
What is this dark? What is this light? We do not understand. Your father and the boy, Calvin, have asked this too. They say that it is night now on our planet, and that they cannot see. They have told us that our atmosphere is what they call opaque, so that the stars are not visible. And then they were surprised that we know stars, that we know their music and the movement of their dance far better than beings like you who spend hours studying them through what you call telescopes. We do not understand what this means, to see.
Well, it's what things look like, Meg said helplessly.
We do not know what things look like, as you say, the beast said. We know what things are like. It must be a very limiting thing, this seeing.
Oh, no, Meg cried. It's the most wonderful thing in the world.
What a very strange world yours must be, the beast said, that such a peculiar seeming thing should be of such importance. Try to tell me, what is this thing called light that you are able to do so little without?
Well, we can't see without it, Meg said, realizing that she was completely unable to explain vision and light and dark. How do you explain sight on a world where no one has ever seen, and where there is no need of eyes?
Well, on this planet, she fumbled, you have a sun, don't you? A most wonderful sun, from which comes our warmth, and the rays which give us our flowers, our food, our music, and all the things which make life and growth.
Well, Meg said, when we are turned toward the sun, our earth, our planet, I mean, toward our sun, we receive its light. And when we're turned away from it, it is night. And if we want to see, we have to use artificial lights.
Artificial lights? The beast sighed. How very complicated life on your planet must be. Later on, you must try to explain some more to me.
All right, Meg promised. And yet she knew that to try to explain anything that could be seen with the eyes would be impossible, because the beast in some way saw, knew, understood far more completely than she or her parents, or Calvin, or even Charles Wallace.
Charles Wallace, she cried. What are they doing about Charles Wallace? We don't know what it's doing to him or making him do. Please, oh, please help us.
Yes, yes, little one. Of course we will help you. A meeting is in session right now to study what is best to do. We have never before been able to talk to anyone who has managed to escape from a dark planet,
So although your father is blaming himself for everything that has happened, we feel that he must be quite an extraordinary person to get out of Kamazots with you at all. But the little boy, and I understand that he is a very special, a very important little boy. Ah, my child, you must accept that this will not be easy. To go back through the black thing, back to Kamazots. I don't know. But father left him, Meg said. He's got to bring him back. He can't just abandon Charles Wallace.
The beast's communication suddenly became crisp. Nobody said anything about abandoning anybody. That is not our way. But we know that just because we want something does not mean that we will get what we want, and we still do not know what to do. And we cannot allow you, in your present state, to do anything that would jeopardize us all. I can see that you wish your father to go rushing back to Kamazots, and you could probably make him do this, and then where would we be? No. You must wait until you are more calm. Now, my darling, here is a robe for you to keep you warm and comfortable.
Meg felt herself being lifted again, and a soft, light garment was slipped about her.
Don't worry about your little brother. The tentacle's musical words were soft against her. We would never leave him behind the shadow. But for now, you must relax. You must be happy. You must get well.
The gentle words, the feeling that this beast would be able to love her no matter what she said or did, lapped Meg in warmth and peace. She felt a delicate touch of tentacle to her cheek, as tender as her mother's kiss.
It is so long since my own small ones were grown and gone, the beast said. You are so tiny and vulnerable. Now I will feed you. You must eat slowly and quietly. I know that you are half starved, that you have been without food far too long. But you must not rush things, or you will not get well.
Something completely and indescribably and incredibly delicious was put to Meg's lips, and she swallowed gratefully. With each swallow, she felt strength returning to her body, and she realized that she had had nothing to eat since the horrible fake turkey dinner on Kamazots, which she had barely tasted. How long ago was her mother's stew? Time no longer had any meaning. How long does night last here? She murmured sleepily. It will be day again, won't it?
Hush, the beast said. Eat, small one.
During the coolness which is now, we sleep. And when you waken, there will be warmth again and many things to do. You must eat now and sleep, and I will stay with you.
What should I call you, please? Meg asked.
Well, now, first try not to say any words for just a moment. Think within your own mind. Think of all the things you call people, different kinds of people.
While Meg thought, the beast murmured to her gently,
No, mother is a special, a one name, and a father you have here, not just friend, nor teacher, nor brother, nor sister. What is acquaintance? What a funny, hard word. Aunt? Maybe? Yes, perhaps that will do. And you think of such odd words about me. Thing and monster? Monster, what a horrid sort of word. I really do not think I am a monster. Beast. That will do. Aunt Beast.
Aunt Beast, Meg murmured sleepily and laughed.
Have I said something funny? Aunt Beast asked in surprise. Isn't Aunt Beast all right?
Aunt Beast is lovely, Meg said. Please sing to me, Aunt Beast. If it was impossible to describe sight to Aunt Beast, it would be even more impossible to describe the singing of Aunt Beast to a human being. It was a music even more glorious than the music of the singing creatures on Uriel. It was a music more tangible than form or sight. It had essence and structure. It supported Meg more firmly than the arms of Aunt Beast. It seemed to travel with her, to sweep her aloft in the power of song, so that she was moving in glory among the stars, and for a moment, she, too, felt that the words darkness and light had no meaning, and only this melody was real. Meg did not know when she fell asleep within the body of the music. When she wakened, Aunt Beast was asleep, too, the softness of her furry, faceless head drooping. Night had gone, and a dull gray light filled the room. But she realized now that here on this planet, there was no need for color, that the grays and browns merging into each other were not what the beasts knew, and that what she herself saw was only the smallest fraction of what the planet was really like. It was she who was limited by her senses, not the blind beasts, for they must have senses of which she could not even dream. She stirred slightly, and Aunt Beast bent over her immediately. "What a lovely sleep, my darling. Do you feel all right?"
"I feel wonderful," Meg said. "Aunt Beast, what is this planet called?"
"Oh, dear," Aunt Beast sighed. "I find it not easy at all to put things the way your mind shapes them. You call where you came from Kamazots?"
"Well, it's where we came from, but it's not our planet."
"You can call us Ixchel, I guess," Aunt Beast told her. "We share the same sun as lost Kamazots, but that, give thanks, is all we share."
"Are you fighting the black thing?" Meg asked.
"Oh, yes," Aunt Beast replied. "In doing that, we can never relax. We are the called according to his purpose, and whom he calls, them he also justifies. Of course, we have help, and without help, it would be much more difficult."
"Who helps you?" Meg asked.
"Oh, dear, it is so difficult to explain things to you, small one. And I know that it is not just because you are a child. The other two are as hard to reach into as you are. What can I tell you that will mean anything to you? Good helps us. The stars help us. Perhaps what you would call light helps us. Love helps us. Oh, my child, I cannot explain. This is something you just have to know or not know.
But
we look not at the things which are what you would call seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal."
"Aunt Beast, do you know Mrs. Watsit?" Meg asked with a sudden flooding of hope.
"Mrs. Watsit?" Aunt Beast was puzzled. "Oh, child, your language is so utterly simple and limited that it has the effect of extreme complication." Her forearms, tentacles waving, were outflung in a gesture of helplessness. "Would you like me to take you to your father and your Calvin?"
"Oh, yes, please."
"Let us go, then. They are waiting for you to make plans, and we thought you would enjoy eating, what is it you call it? Oh, yes, breakfast together. You will be too warm in that heavy fur now. I will dress you in something lighter, and then we will go." As though Meg were a baby, Aunt Beast bathed and dressed her, and this new garment, though it was made of a pale fur, was lighter than the lightest summer clothes on Earth. Aunt Beast put one tentacled arm around Meg's waist and led her through long, dim corridors in which she could see only shadows and shadows of shadows until they reached a large, columned chamber. Shafts of light came in from an open skylight and converged about a huge round stone table. Here were seated several of the great beasts, and Calvin and Mr. Murray, on a stone bench that circled the table. Because the beasts were so tall, even Mr. Murray's feet did not touch the ground, and lanky Calvin's long legs dangled as though he were Charles Wallace. The hall was partially enclosed by vaulted arches leading to long paved walks. There were no empty walls, no covering roofs, so that although the light was dull in comparison to Earth's sunlight, Meg had no feeling of dark or of chill. As Aunt Beast led Meg in, Mr. Murray slid down from the bench and hurried to her, putting his arms about her tenderly. "They promised us you were all right," he said. While she had been in Aunt Beast's arms, Meg had felt safe and secure. Now, her worries about Charles Wallace and her disappointment in her father's human fallibility rose like a gorge in her throat. "I'm fine," she muttered, looking not at Calvin or her father, but at the beasts. For it was to them she turned now for help. It seemed to her that neither her father nor Calvin were properly concerned about Charles Wallace. "Meg," Calvin said gaily, "you've never tasted such food in your life. Come and eat." Aunt Beast lifted Meg up onto the bench and sat down beside her, then heaped a plate with food, strange fruits and breads that tasted unlike anything Meg had ever eaten. Everything was dull and colorless and unappetizing to look at, and at first, even remembering the meal Aunt Beast had fed her the night before, Meg hesitated to taste. But once she had managed the first bite, she ate eagerly. It seemed that she would never have her fill again. The others waited until she slowed down. Then Mr. Murray said gravely, "We were trying to work out a plan to rescue Charles Wallace, since I made such a mistake in tessering away from it. We feel that it would not be wise for me to try to get back to Kamazotz even alone. If I missed the mark again, I could easily get lost and wander forever from galaxy to galaxy, and that would be small help to anyone, least of all to Charles Wallace." Such a wave of despondency came over Meg that she was no longer able to eat. "Our friends here," he continued, "feel that it was only the fact that I still wore the glasses your Mrs. Who gave you that kept me within the solar system. Here are the glasses, Meg, but I'm afraid that the virtue has gone from them, and now they are only glass. Perhaps they were meant to help only once and only on Kamazotz. Perhaps it was going through the black thing that did it." He pushed the glasses across the table at her. "These people know about tessering," Calvin gestured at the circle of great beasts, "but they can't do it onto a dark planet."
"Have you tried to call Mrs. Watsit?" Meg asked.
"Not yet," her father answered.
"But if you haven't thought of anything else, it's the only thing to do. Father, don't you care about Charles at all?"
At that, Aunt Beast stood up saying, "Child," in a reproving way. Mr. Murray said nothing, and Meg could see that she had wounded him deeply. She reacted as she would have reacted to Mr. Jenkins. She scowled down at the table, saying, "We've got to ask them for help now. You're just stupid if you think we don't." Aunt Beast spoke to the others. "The child is distraught. Don't judge her harshly. She was almost taken by the black thing. Sometimes we can't know what spiritual damage it leaves, even when physical recovery is complete." Meg looked angrily around the table. The beast sat there, silent, motionless. She felt that she was being measured and found wanting. Calvin swung away from her and hunched himself up.
"Hasn't it occurred to you that we've been trying to tell them about our ladies? What do you think we've been up to all this time, just stuffing our faces? Okay, you have a shot at it."
Yes, try, child.
Aunt Beast seated herself again and pulled Meg up beside her.
But I do not understand this feeling of anger I sense in you. What is it about? There is blame going on and guilt? Why?
Aunt Beast, don't you know?
No, Aunt Beast said. But this is not telling me about whoever they are you want us to know. Try.
Meg tried, blunderingly, fumblingly. At first, she described Mrs. Watsit and her man's coat and multicolored shawls and scarves, Mrs. Who and her white robes and shimmering spectacles, Mrs. Witch in her peaked cap and black gown quivering in and out of body. Then she realized that this was absurd. She was describing them only to herself. This wasn't Mrs. Watsit or Mrs. Who or Mrs. Witch. She might as well have described Mrs. Watsit as she was when she took on the form of a flying creature of Uriel.
Don't try to use words, Aunt Beast said soothingly. You're just fighting yourself and me. Think about what they are. This look doesn't help us at all.
Meg tried again, but she could not get a visual concept out of her mind. She tried to think of Mrs. Watsit explaining tessering. She tried to think of them in terms of mathematics. Every once in a while, she thought she felt a flicker of understanding from Aunt Beast or one of the others. But most of the time, all that emanated from them was gentle puzzlement.
Angels! Calvin shouted suddenly from across the table. Guardian angels!
There was a moment's silence, and he shouted again, his face tense with concentration.
Messengers! Messengers of God!
I thought for a moment.
Aunt Bee started, then subsided, sighing.
No, it's not clear enough. How strange it is that they can't tell us what they themselves seem to know,
a tall, thin beast murmured. One of Aunt Beast's tentacled arms went around Meg's waist again.
They are very young, and on their Earth, as they call it, they never communicate with other planets. They revolve about all alone in space.
Oh, the thin beast said.
Aren't they lonely?
Suddenly, a thundering voice reverberated throughout the great hall.
We are here.
Chapter 12, The Foolish and the Weak. Meg could see nothing, but she felt her heart pounding with hope. With one accord, all the beasts rose to their feet, turned toward one of the arched openings, and bowed their heads and tentacles in greeting. Mrs. Watsit appeared, standing between two columns. Beside her came Mrs. Who, behind them a quivering of light. The three of them were somehow not quite the same as they had been when Meg had first seen them. Their outlines seemed blurred. Colors ran together as in a wet watercolor painting. But they were there. They were recognizable. They were themselves. Meg pulled herself away from Aunt Beast, jumped to the floor, and rushed at Mrs. Watsit. But Mrs. Watsit held up a warning hand, and Meg realized that she was not completely materialized, that she was light and not substance, and embracing her now would have been like trying to hug a sunbeam.
We had to hurry, so there wasn't quite time. You wanted us?
Mrs. Watsit asked. The tallest of the beasts bowed again and took a step away from the table and towards Mrs. Watsit.
It is a question of the little boy.
Father left him, Meg cried. He left him on Kamazots.
Appallingly, Mrs. Watsit's voice was cold.
And what do you expect us to do?
Meg pressed her knuckles against her teeth so that her braces cut her skin. Then she flung out her arms pleadingly.
But it's Charles Wallace. It has him, Mrs. Watson. Save him, please save him.
You know that we can do nothing on Kamazots, Mrs. Watson said, her voice still cold.
You mean you'll let Charles be caught by it forever?
Meg's voice rose shrilly.
Did I say that?
But we can't do anything, you know we can't. We tried, Mrs. Watson. You have to save him.
Meg, this is not our way, Mrs. Watson said sadly. I thought you would know that this is not our way.
Mr. Murray took a step forward and bowed, and to Meg's amazement, the three ladies bowed back to him.
I don't believe we've been introduced, Mrs. Watson said.
It's Father. You know it's Father. Meg's angry impatience grew. Father, Mrs. Watson, Mrs. Who, and Mrs. Which.
I'm very glad to, Mr. Murray mumbled, then went on. Oh, I'm sorry, my glasses are broken and I can't see you very well.
It's not necessary to see us, Mrs. Watson said.
If you could teach me enough more about the Tesseract so that I could get back to Kamazots.
What then?
Came Mrs. Witch's surprising voice.
I will try to take my child away from it.
And you know that you will not succeed?
There's nothing left except to try. Mrs. Watson spoke gently.
I'm sorry. We cannot allow you to go.
Then let me, Calvin suggested. I almost got him away before.
Mrs. Watson shook her head.
No, Calvin, Charles has gone even deeper into it. You will not be permitted to throw yourself in with him, for that, you must realize, is what would happen.
There was a long silence. All the soft rays filtering into the great hall seemed to concentrate on Mrs. Watson, Mrs. Who, and the faint light that must be Mrs. Witch. No one spoke. One of the beasts moved a tendril slowly back and forth across the stone tabletop. At last, Meg could stand it no longer, and she cried out despairingly.
Then what are you going to do? Are you just going to throw Charles away?
Mrs. Witch's voice rolled formidably across the hall.
Silence, child.
But Meg could not be silent. She pressed closely against Aunt Beast, but Aunt Beast did not put the protecting tentacles around her.
I can't go, Meg cried. I can't, you know I can't.
Did anybody ask you to?
The grim voice made Meg's skin prickle into goose flesh. She burst into tears. She started beating at Aunt Beast like a small child having a tantrum. Her tears rained down her face and spattered Aunt Beast's fur. Aunt Beast stood quietly against the assault.
All right, I'll go, Meg sobbed. I know you want me to go.
We want nothing from you that you do without grace, Mrs. Watson said, or that you do without understanding.
Meg's tears stopped as abruptly as they had started.
But I do understand. She felt tired and unexpectedly peaceful. Now, the coldness that, under Aunt Beast's ministrations, had left her body had also left her mind. She looked toward her father, and her confused anger was gone, and she felt only love and pride. She smiled at him, asking forgiveness, and then pressed up against Aunt Beast. This time, Aunt Beast's arm went around her. Mrs. Witch's voice was grave.
What do you understand?
That it has to be me. It can't be anyone else. I don't understand Charles, but he understands me. I'm the one who's closest to him. Father's been away for so long, since Charles Wallace was a baby. They don't know each other. And Calvin's only known Charles for such a little time. If it had been longer, then he would have been the one, but... Oh, I see. I see. I understand. It has to be me. There isn't anyone else.
Mr. Murray, who had been sitting, his elbows on his knees, his chin on his fists, rose.
I will not allow it.
Why?
Mrs. Witch demanded.
Look, I don't know what or who you are, and at this point I don't care. I will not allow my daughter to go alone into this danger.
Why?
You know what the outcome will probably be, and she's weak now, weaker than she was before. She was almost killed by the black thing. I fail to understand how you can even consider such a thing.
Calvin jumped down.
Maybe it's right about you, or maybe you're in league with it. I'm the one to go if anybody goes. Why did you bring me along at all to take care of Meg? You said so yourself.
But you have done that, Mrs. Watson assured him.
I haven't done anything, Calvin shouted. You can't send Meg. I won't allow it. I'll put my foot down. I won't permit it.
Don't you see that you're making something that is already hard for Meg even harder?
Mrs. Watson asked him. Aunt Beast turned tentacles toward Mrs. Watson.
Is she strong enough to tesser again? You know what she has been through.
If Witch takes her, she can manage, Mrs. Watson said.
If it will help, I could go too and hold her.
Aunt Beast's arm around Meg tightened.
Oh, Aunt Beast, Meg started, but Mrs. Watson cut her off. No!
I was afraid not, Aunt Beast said humbly. I just wanted you to know that I would.
Mrs., what's it?
Mr. Murray frowned and pushed his hair back from his face. Then he shoved with his middle finger at his nose as though he were trying to get spectacles closer to his eyes.
Are you remembering that she is only a child?
And she's backward, Calvin bellowed. I resent that, Meg said hotly, hoping that indignation would control her trembling. I'm better than you at math, and you know it.
Do you have the courage to go alone? Mrs. Watson asked her.
Meg's voice was flat.
No, but it doesn't matter.
She turned to her father and Calvin.
You know it's the only thing to do. You know they'd never send me alone if...
How do we know they're not in league with it?
Mr. Murray demanded.
Father!
No, Meg, Mrs. Watson said. I do not blame your father for being angry and suspicious and frightened, and I cannot pretend that we are doing anything but sending you into the gravest kind of danger. I have to acknowledge quite openly that it may be a fatal danger. I know this, but I do not believe it. And the happy medium doesn't believe it either.
Can't she see what's going to happen?
Calvin asked.
Oh, not in this kind of thing.
Mrs. Watson sounded surprised at his question.
If we knew ahead of time what was going to happen, we'd be like the people on Camazotz, with no lives of our own, with everything all planned and done for us. How can I explain it to you? Oh, I know. In your language, you have a form of poetry called the sonnet.
Yes, yes, Calvin said impatiently. What's that got to do with a happy medium?
Kindly pay me the courtesy of listening to me.
Mrs. Watson's voice was stern, and for a moment Calvin stopped pawing the ground like a nervous colt.
It is a very strict form of poetry, is it not?
Yes.
There are 14 lines, I believe, all in iambic pentameter. That's a very strict rhythm or meter, yes?
Yes, Calvin nodded.
And each line has to end with a rigid rhyme pattern? And if the poet does not do it exactly this way, it is not a sonnet, is it?
No.
But within this strict form, the poet has complete freedom to say whatever he wants, doesn't he?
Yes,
Calvin nodded again.
So,
Mrs. Watson said.
So what?
Oh, do not be stupid, boy, Mrs. Watson scolded. You know perfectly well what I'm driving at.
You mean you're comparing our lives to a sonnet? A strict form, but freedom within it?
Yes, Mrs. Watson said. You're given the form, but you have to write the sonnet yourself. What you say is completely up to you.
Please, Meg said, please. If I've got to go, I want to go and get it over with. Each minute you put it off makes it harder.
She is right, boomed Mrs. Witch's voice. It is time.
You may say goodbye. Mrs. Watson was giving her not permission, but a command. Meg curtsied clumsily to the beasts.
Thank you all very much. I know you saved my life.
She did not add what she could not help thinking. Saved it for what? So that it could get me? She put her arms around Aunt Beast, pressed up against the soft, fragrant fur.
Thank you, she whispered. I love you.
And I you, little one.
Aunt Beast pressed gentle tendrils against Meg's face.
Cal,
Meg said, holding out her hand. Calvin came to her and took her hand, then drew her roughly to him and kissed her. He didn't say anything, and he turned away before he had a chance to see the surprised happiness that brightened Meg's eyes. At last, she turned to her father.
I'm sorry, father.
He took both her hands in his, bent down to her with his short-sighted eyes.
Sorry for what, Megatron?
Tears almost came to her eyes at the gentle use of the old nickname.
I wanted you to do it all for me. I wanted everything to be all easy and simple. So I tried to pretend that it was all your fault, because I was scared, and I didn't want to have to do anything myself.
But I wanted to do it for you, Mr. Murray said. That's what every parent wants.
He looked into her dark, frightened eyes.
I won't let you go, Meg. I am going.
No. Mrs. Watson's voice was sterner than Meg had ever heard it.
You are going to allow Meg the privilege of accepting this danger. You are a wise man, Mr. Murray. You are going to let her go.
Mr. Murray sighed. He drew Meg close to him.
Little Megaparsec, don't be afraid to be afraid. We will try to have courage for you. That is all we can do. Your mother.
Mother was always shoving me out in the world, Meg said. She'd want me to do this, you know she would. Tell her.
She started, choked, then held up her head and said,
No. Never mind. I'll tell her myself.
Good girl, of course you will.
Now, Meg walked slowly around the great table to where Mrs. Watson was still poised between the columns.
Are you going with me?
No, only Mrs. Witch.
The black thing? Fear made her voice tremble. When Father tessered me through it, it almost got me.
Your father is singularly inexperienced, Mrs. Watson said. Though a fine man and worth teaching, at the moment he still treats tessering as though he were working with a machine. We will not let the black thing get you, I don't think. This was not exactly comforting. The momentary vision and faith that had come to Meg dwindled.
But suppose I can't get Charles Wallace away from it.
Stop! Mrs. Watson held up her hand. We gave you gifts the last time we took you to Kamazotz. We will not let you go empty-handed this time. But what we can give you now is nothing you can touch with your hands. I give you my love, Meg. Never forget that. My love, always. Mrs. Who, eyes shining behind spectacles, beamed at Meg.
Meg felt in her blazer pocket and handed back the spectacles she had used on Kamazats.
Your father is right.
Mrs. Hu took the spectacles and hid them somewhere in the folds of her robes.
The virtue is gone from them. And what I have to give you this time, you must try to understand, not word by word, but in a flash, as you understand the Tesseract. Listen, Meg. Listen well. The foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. For ye see your calling, brethren, how that not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called. But God hath chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise, and God hath chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty. And base things of the world, and things which are despised, hath God chosen, yea, and things which are not, to bring to naught things that are.
She paused, and then she said,
May the right prevail.
Her spectacles seemed to flicker. Behind her, through her, one of the columns became visible. There was a final gleam from the glasses, and she was gone. Meg looked nervously to where Mrs. Watsit had been standing before Mrs. Hu spoke, but Mrs. Watsit was no longer there.
No,
Mr. Murray cried and stepped toward Meg. Mrs. Witch's voice came through her shimmer.
I cannot hold your hand, child.
Immediately, Meg was swept into darkness, into nothingness, and then into the icy, devouring cold of the black thing. Mrs. Witch won't let it get me, she thought over and over while the cold of the black thing seemed to crunch at her bones. Then they were through it, and she was standing breathlessly on her feet on the same hill on which they had first landed on Kamazats. She was cold and a little numb, but no worse than she had often been in the winter in the country when she had spent an afternoon skating on the pond. She looked around. She was completely alone. Her heart began to pound. Then, seeming to echo from all around her, came Mrs. Witch's unforgettable voice.
I have not given you my gift. You have something that it has not. This something is your only weapon, but you must find it for yourself.
Then the voice ceased, and Meg knew that she was alone. She walked slowly down the hill, her heart thumping painfully against her ribs. There below her was the same row of identical houses they had seen before, and beyond these the linear buildings of the city. She walked along the quiet street. It was dark, and the street was deserted. No children playing ball or skipping rope, no mother figures at the doors, no father figures returning from work. In the same window of each house was a light. And as Meg walked down the street, all the lights were extinguished simultaneously. Was it because of her presence, or was it simply that it was time for lights out? She felt numb, beyond rage or disappointment or even fear. She put one foot ahead of the other with precise regularity, not allowing her pace to lag. She was not thinking. She was not planning. She was simply walking slowly but steadily toward the city and the domed building where it lay. Now she approached the outlying buildings of the city. In each of them was a vertical line of light, but it was a dim, eerie light, not the warm light of stairways and cities at home. And there were no isolated, brightly lit windows where someone was working late or an office was being cleaned. Out of each building came one man, perhaps a watchman, and each man started walking the width of the building. They appeared not to see her. At any rate, they paid no attention to her whatsoever, and she went on past them. "What have I got that it hasn't got?" she thought suddenly. "What have I possibly got?" Now, she was walking by the tallest of the business buildings. More dim vertical lines of light. The walls glowed slightly to give a faint illumination to the streets. Central Intelligence was ahead of her. Was the man with red eyes still sitting there, or was he allowed to go to bed? But this was not where she must go, though the man with red eyes seemed the kind old gentleman he claimed to be when compared with it. But he was no longer of any consequence in the search for Charles Wallace. She must go directly to it. It isn't used to being resisted. Father said that's how he managed, and how Calvin and I managed as long as we did. Father saved me then. There's nobody here to save me now. I have to do it myself. I have to resist it by myself. Is that what I have that it hasn't got? No, I'm sure it can resist. It just isn't used to having other people resist. Central Intelligence blocked with its huge rectangle the end of the square. She turned to walk around it, and almost imperceptibly her steps slowed. It was not far to the great dome which housed it. I'm going to Charles Wallace. That's what's important. That's what I have to think of. I wish I could feel numb again the way I did at first. Suppose it has him somewhere else. Suppose he isn't there. I have to go there first, anyhow. That's the only way I can find out. Her steps got slower and slower as she passed the great bronzed doors, the huge slabs of the Central Intelligence building, as she finally saw ahead of her the strange, light, pulsing dome of it. Father said it was all right for me to be afraid. He said to go ahead and be afraid. And Mrs. Who said, I don't understand what she said, but I think it was meant to make me not hate being only me, and me being the way I am. And Mrs. Watson said to remember that she loves me. That's what I have to think about. Not about being afraid, or not as smart as it. Mrs. Watson loves me. That's quite something, to be loved by someone like Mrs. Watson. She was there. No matter how slowly her feet had taken her at the end, they had taken her there. Directly ahead of her was the circular building, its walls glowing with violet flame, its silvery roof pulsing with a light that seemed to Meg to be insane. Again, she could feel the light, neither warm nor cold, but reaching out to touch her, pulling her toward it. There was a sudden sucking, and she was within. It was as though the wind had been knocked out of her. She gasped for breath in her own rhythm, not the permeating pulsing of it. She could feel the inexorable beat within her body, controlling her heart, her lungs, but not herself, not Meg. It did not quite have her. She blinked her eyes rapidly and against the rhythm until the redness before them cleared and she could see. There was the brain. There was it, lying, pulsing, and quivering on the dais, soft and exposed and nauseating. Charles Wallace was crouched beside it, his eyes still slowly twirling, his jaw still slack, as she had seen him before, with a tick in his forehead, reiterating the revolting rhythm of it. As she saw him, it was again as though she had been punched in the stomach, for she had to realize afresh that she was seeing Charles and yet
it was not Charles at all. Where was Charles Wallace, her own beloved Charles Wallace? What is it I have got that it hasn't got?
You have nothing that it hasn't got, Charles Wallace said coldly. How nice to have you back, dear sister. We have been waiting for you. We knew that Mrs. Watsit would send you. She is our friend, you know.
For an appalling moment, Meg believed, and in that moment she felt her brain being gathered up into it. No! She screamed at the top of her lungs. No, you lie! For a moment, she was free from its clutches again. As long as I can stay angry enough, it can't get me. Is that what I have that it doesn't have?
Nonsense, Charles Wallace said. You have nothing that it doesn't have.
You're lying, she replied, and she felt only anger toward this boy who was not Charles Wallace at all. No, it was not anger. It was loathing. It was hatred, sheer and unadulterated. And as she became lost in hatred, she also began to be lost in it. The red miasma swam before her eyes. Her stomach churned in its rhythm. Her body trembled with the strength of her hatred and the strength of it. With the last vestige of consciousness, she jerked her mind and body. Hate was nothing that it didn't have. It knew all about hate. You are lying about that, and you were lying about Mrs. Watsit, she screamed.
Mrs. Watsit hates you, Charles Wallace said.
And that was where it made its fatal mistake. For as Meg said automatically, Mrs. Watsit loves me, that's what she told me, that she loves me. Suddenly, she knew. She knew. Love. That was what she had that it did not have. She had Mrs. Watsit's love, and her father's, and her mother's, and the real Charles Wallace's love, and the twins, and Aunt Beast's. And she had her love for them. But how could she use it? What was she meant to do? If she could give love to it, perhaps it would shrivel up and die, for she was sure that it could not withstand love. But she, in all her weakness and foolishness and baseness and nothingness, was incapable of loving it. Perhaps it was not too much to ask of her, but she could not do it. But she could love Charles Wallace. She could stand there, and she could love Charles Wallace. Her own Charles Wallace, the real Charles Wallace, the child for whom she had come back to Kamazots, to it, the baby who was so much more than she was, and who was yet so utterly vulnerable. She could love Charles Wallace. Charles, Charles, I love you, my baby brother who always takes care of me. Come back to me, Charles Wallace. Come away from it. Come back. Come home. I love you, Charles. Oh, Charles Wallace, I love you. Tears were streaming down her cheeks, but she was unaware of them. Now she was even able to look at him, at this animated thing that was not her own Charles Wallace at all. She was able to look and love. I love you, Charles Wallace. You are my darling and my dear and the light of my life and the treasure of my heart. I love you. I love you. I love you. Slowly, his mouth closed. Slowly, his eyes stopped their twirling. The tick in the forehead ceased its revolting twitch. Slowly, he advanced toward her. I love you, she cried. I love you, Charles. I love you. Then suddenly he was running, pelting. He was in her arms. He was shrieking with sobs. Meg,
Meg, Meg! I love you, Charles, she cried again, her sobs almost as loud as